Right, so it is May 26th, 2026. Oh, you got 26 twice. And I was just beginning to explain why we meditate before the talk. As I was saying, sometimes people think, well, it'd be good to like have a talk first to kind of set me up to meditate, which is not a crazy suggestion by any means. But the idea is that when we meditate, we prepare our minds to hear the Dharma. And that a mind which is a little more spacious or settled, rather less distracted, is more receptive and more likely to hear the Dharma to be for insight to arise in the talk. I can't guarantee that that will happen. But so I just wanted to sort of frame that for once. I also will say that I am pretty far behind in terms of posting the existing recordings, and there were those that I recorded, so we'll see if I'm capable of finding those. Anyway, yeah, let's start to sit. Just settling back into a comfortable posture that supports your calming and clarity. And these are two, say, to some extent, competing energies that we work with as meditators. One is obviously the intention to settle and bring a comfortable, peaceful inner state. But then that also needs to be balanced with energy so that one doesn't just get groggy or dull in the mind. And this is one of the reasons why posture is important, because if we sit upright, we're more able to activate some energy in the body, maintain some energy that will help the mind to be bright. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. So turning the attention inward, the simple question of how do you feel? And this is a question that relates both to the mood or emotional level as well as the physical level, the energetic. You don't have to necessarily address both those things, but really, what stands out? What do you, or how do you, would you respond if someone asked you right now how you feel and they really cared? And you're going to really tell them. So, bringing mindfulness to just the felt state, felt experience, with a sense of openness, acceptance, non-resistance to what is present, whether it is something you enjoy or something not so pleasant. Seeing if you can just be aware without judgment. And then beginning to refine the attention toward the breath. Feel the sensations of breathing. And do this in a very close way where we touch into the sensations right at the nostrils or the upper lip. Sensations of breathing in and breathing out. We can also be mindful of the breath in a broader way, a more open way, where we feel the whole body, the way the breath moves through the body. Through the chest and the belly, even the back, areas that we don't typically associate with breathing. Now, there's no right or wrong way to be mindful of the breath. Rather, what works for you? What are you drawn to? Natural for the mind to wander. So part of this process certainly is to bring the attention back when we lose contact with the breath, with the body, the present moment. We also want to notice what is our relationship to our thoughts. Are we infatuated by our thinking? Are we resistant and aversive? I don't want to turn meditation into a struggle, wrestling with thoughts. We're trying to wrestle them away. At the same time, we don't want to just indulge in daydream. So we could say that we work toward another kind of balance, that's a sort of openness that doesn't fight with thoughts but doesn't chase them, allows them to move through. That our primary attention is with the breath and the more spacious mind. Maybe thoughts are just moving through in the background, and that's okay. We don't have to maintain, attain some level of perfect silence in the mind. But in those moments when thoughts completely capture our attention, then we want to see that, feel that, let go, come back, restart our attention on the breath. It's often helpful to tune into the body after, right? After recognizing that the mind has been captured by thoughts. to see how those thoughts are manifesting in the body, the feelings that are triggered by those thoughts, and breathe with those feelings, those nonverbal experiences. So it allows us a more natural and comfortable settling rather than a struggle to shut down the thoughts, to feel the interconnection between thought and feeling, sensation, emotion, this flow of experience. Again, the breath is our companion through this whole process. Trustworthy partner. Okay, ding. Don't have a bell, and I know if I were more something technological, I would just ring a digital bell, but we usually have a bell. Couldn't find one before I left last week. As I mentioned, I'm just starting to get a cold, and so not in the best condition. I'm putting a cough drop in my mouth now to soothe the throat. And then I'm going to mute so I can blow my nose. So, what to reflect on today? The retreat that I just came from was in Big Bear Retreat Center, and I was co-teaching with Vimala Sara, who has a book called 8-Step Recovery. And it's not a program that I've studied particularly, but we had a couple of meetings, and I was impressed by particularly the 8 steps. And there was one step in there that I really responded to, which was the making positive,
Hello. Hello.
putting. I'm
Yes.
sorry. I think we need to mute all. Thank you. One of the 8 steps that she has kind of created, which some of which are like the Four Noble Truths, basically. One of them is something like placing positive values at the center of your life. And that really resonated for me because I think sometimes, like, first of all, sobriety can seem like it's just one thing, like, oh, I don't drink and take drugs. And of course, in the beginning, that's what it is. And Buddhism, in its own way, can become a kind of something we kind of fetishize. I meditate and I study something, or I have a teacher. But with both, where I think both the Dharma and recovery come to fruition is when they become the guiding principles, the center of our lives, and not just particular things like going to meetings or meditating or going on retreats, but embracing the whole of the path. And that even the way we work with the precepts in Buddhism can be this sort of narrowing of it. And so the term sila, which we often kind of just say is, oh, that's the five precepts, it means much more than that. It really means placing positive values in the center of your life. And so being here with my nephew's family, and he got sober when I was 10 years sober. So, I think of him as being like, oh yeah, well, he got sober. He's been sober for a little while. Well, that's 30 years ago. So, and at that time he was single, and he went and stayed with his father in Ohio to after he went to rehab in Ohio, and then came out, and he'd been, chipping on heroin, and I think alcohol also been a problem. And but he really his life completely turned around, and gradually built, built himself a career and found a partner. And I actually was the officiant of his wedding, which was about probably 16 or 17 years ago. Not sure. But as I said before, he's got a 14-year-old daughter, my grandniece, and a son who's 11. And they had a really nice, not big, but a nice Memorial Day party yesterday, and there were some people who were having alcohol, but like weird things that people drink now, like in cans. I don't know what it is, but it was not at all. There was no sense of intoxication, and there were a bunch of sober people, and the sense that of like that their home seems like a happy place, you know what I mean? Like a sane, happy place. And I know many of us who grew up as alcoholics and in alcoholic environments, it can be strange to see that. Oh, this is what normal is, right? This is what happy is. And there's nothing fancy about it. I mean, they have the ordinary things, rushing to get the kids to school this morning and, cleaning up the party last night and whatever, just nothing. They're not all meditating together or something, or chanting, It's just like, oh, a happy, healthy family, And again, I mean, I remember when I was in my early sobriety, I think it was some recording, like a cassette or something that I listened to. But anyway, talking, hearing someone talk about the idea of a functional family, and realizing how alien that was to me. That, I mean, I loved my family. I thought it was great, but it was not. It was not ideal. It was really an alcoholic environment. Not in an obvious way, but in the way that many families can be, middle class families with, affluent and educated, where it's like cocktail parties, and, you make the martini at 5 o'clock because that's like normal, And when you grow up in that environment, again, I'm just speaking to the choir here, but when you grow up in that environment, it never occurs to you that you wouldn't drink. It's just that you're kind of, for me, I was kind of like, I wasn't even waiting for it, but I just knew that was coming. And indeed, if I knew of someone who didn't drink, I thought that anybody who didn't drink, and I didn't really know anybody who didn't drink, basically. But if I thought about people who didn't drink, I thought they were kind of weird, cult in some religious cult or something. It didn't make any sense to me that they were kind of like antisocial, if you didn't drink. It was like, oh, like you're like something's wrong with you. There was one, actually, a cousin of mine married to a cousin who was an identified alcoholic. And this is over 65 years ago, probably, like, and so he knew, I'm sure, Bill Wilson, and sort of was going to meetings in the early 1950s and through the 60s, and he would drink Cokes at our parties. And I didn't think much about it, but it was there. So that's good. I mean, I think it's good to have some kind of a model, right? Like he wasn't a weird cultist, he was a normal human being. I'm not, as I said, I'm not really in the sharpest mind state right now to give a Dharma talk. I'm just talking about what's sort of around me. I think the other thing that I'll just sort of move to, because it's sort of on my mind, and was like the frailty of our mind-body experience. And on retreat, and I kind of got, I felt very aware of this. Toward the last day or so of the retreat, just teaching, and And the fact that I got a cold is sort of like emblematic of that. That our ordinary, what we think of as normal is this very narrow spectrum. And that oftentimes we drift outside that spectrum, whether it's how you feel when you wake up in the morning or when you meditate, when you're upset about something, and it's like, oh, this isn't ideal, and the what's our relationship to our frailty as human beings, I guess, is sort of the Dharma question for me. And I think, when I'm teaching a retreat, and when I'm working with people on a retreat, I see how people struggle with discomfort, basically, And, at the beginning of a retreat, most everyone is uncomfortable, both physically and mentally. And their relationship to that is, conflicted. It's like they don't want it to be that way. And they either sort of blame themselves, sort of think, what's wrong with me? I need to be meditating better or harder or something. Or this isn't really the right thing for me. These teachings don't really work for me. Instead of, oh, this is what unpleasant feels like. And as the Buddha really challenges us, like, can I broaden my spectrum of acceptability? Can the unpleasant be more acceptable to me? And here I am, like, having a cold and like, thinking about taking a long drive today. I'm like, and part of that is like, okay, I'm taking Tylenol, right? And I've got like a book on tape to listen to in the car and some tea, and I'll have snacks, sort of the comfort things. But it's also that, like, am I gonna let myself get wrapped up in being frustrated and hating this, or can I be like, this kind of sucks, but it's okay? Which is kind of, in a way, that's my mantra. This kind of sucks, but it's okay, and because that's, I mean, in a way, we could say that's Buddhist teachings, There is suffering, but there's a path to dealing with it. And and particularly in this kind of state, in this kind of getting a cold kind of state, but it's, I felt it very much on the retreat too, when sometimes things are changing really rapidly. And then it's really interesting because, like, if I have a cup of tea right now, like, oh, I feel better. And then, like, 15 minutes later, I'm like, oh, I feel crappy again. And it's like, oh, well, let me, let me stretch. Or, and we do this on retreat a lot. Like, you're like, oh, God, I'm meditating. Oh, they rang the bell. Great. Oh, walking meditation. Oh, this is nice. Oh, no, this is getting boring, man. Oh, when's lunch? Oh, lunch. Oh, that was lunch is so great. Oh, man, no, I'm so tired. I ate too much. And it, you're just sort of like in this cycle, right? And it's that the question is, are we, well, we're in that normal cycle of persistent change, of subtle and not so subtle mind-body changes that happen in the course of a day. What's my relationship to that? Am I constantly trying to get into the narrow spectrum of what I think of as okay? Or is there a little bit more of a sense of ease, like, okay, this is unpleasant and it's okay. It's unpleasant, but it's okay. And oh, now it's pleasant again. Well, that's nice. I'll enjoy that. I mean, in a way, I feel like, I'm just talking about life, which I guess I am. I mean, that's what the Dharma is. It's the story of life. These sort of things come up because, I mean, I was talking to him. I have another niece who lives down here who's about to turn 60. And she was at the barbecue yesterday. And, she was asking me how I was doing, of course. And I was like, well, these days I think of the fall as the surgery season. She thought that was kind of funny. And, but you should write something about that, which, sure. But particularly as we get older, not just older, but older, there's less and less stability in terms of the physical state. And so when I noticed that over the past couple of months, while I've been feeling physically good, that I start to think this is normal. And this is how it's great. Now I've like taken care of that problem and I got over that cold and now I'm really, everything's good. And then as soon as I started to feel I was getting this cold, I was like, oh shit, this is like, that was an, I fell for it again. That like I had reached some stasis. I had reached some place where like, okay, now it's going to be like this. Like, no, that was pleasant. And now there's this. And I mean, this is what, one of the ways that one of the things the Buddha is referring to when he talks about everything being impermanent. But again, what is so interesting is what we think of as normal, and then what we think of as not normal. Like when I'm sick, that's not normal. But when I'm healthy, that's normal. Well, that's not true. Both of them are normal. They're just the existence. But it's again seeing our relationship. It's like the when I act like an asshole, that's not really who I am. Who I really, when people say, oh, I mean, and this is like the apology that you see from the public apology by the public person who did something bad, and they're like, that's not who I really am, and I'm really sorry, I that's not, I didn't mean to say something like that, that's not really who I am, as if like, oh yeah, when I'm being an asshole, that's not really me, that's just an aberration. I'm like, no, that's me, the asshole me, and then there's the good me and the nice me and the stupid me and the smart me and the all those different selves, versions of variations of this personality. But again, we want to identify with the positive, with the pleasant. We don't want to identify with the unpleasant or the unwholesome. And to me, this is one of the challenges that the Dharma puts to us. Am I willing to look at the whole of it, the whole of life, the whole of experience, from the ugly to the beautiful? Am I willing to look at myself in all those ways and accept all of those things and see them as all normal? And that does not mean that I don't also try to cultivate the wholesome and let go of the unwholesome. That's right effort. But it means that when the unwholesome or the unhelpful or whatever, the uncomfortable is there, I don't pretend that it's some kind of an aberration. I work with it as part of the whole spectrum of existence and of self. So I think I started to sound somewhat like a Dharma teacher there. So I better quit while I'm ahead here. And if there are any questions or comments, thank you for your kind attention. And I do note that in the chat, someone has noted that I'm coming to Nevada City soon. That is true. I'll be at the Mountain Stream Meditation Center sometime soon. It could be next week, but I would have to look at a calendar to know. Let's see, what is this week? There's that week. Yep, looks like next week. June 5, 6, 7. If anybody is in the foothills of the Sierras, that's where I will be. So that's the extent of my promotion for the day. Thank you. Oh, Pam, hi. I'm sorry. I was like scrolling, looking at different calendar and thinking, oh,
Thank you.
hands up.
and hello, friends. I think that your next book should be called The Myth of Stasis, because
Okay.
I
Yeah.
really resonated with when you were saying that you, and it, I think this really applies in recovery too. If I just get to this point, I'll be cured. If I just get to this point, I can breathe. And every day I go through that.
Yeah.
I just got to get the
Yeah.
and but the lesson is, as you said, is to broaden our concept of acceptability and to think that we can get to a place where no change is happening. That's just a myth. And so I think I'll make that kind of a mantra for me too, that this kind of sucks, but that's okay. It will change. But anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Well, as I like to say, when someone suggests that I write a book about something, why don't you write that book? Okay, that's my response. John.
Hey, Kevin. That is a great title, The Myth of Stasis. I mean, it is
Thank
so
you.
true. And it's every day I wake up and I think, this is it. The pain's gone. Very, very poignant. But I have a personal question, and feel free to just go, I'm not going to really answer that. But yeah, right. Like my other questions for you. So does your nephew and your niece perceive you as just Uncle Kevin, or are you Kevin the Dharma teacher? Are you Kevin the author? Because I see you as, Kevin the author, Kevin the Dharma
Right.
teacher. I'm just kind of curious that, like I said, don't feel obligated to answer that, but it
Well,
just came to my head.
obviously, I mean, the real answer to that is you'd have to ask them. But I will say that my relationship, I've historically had very close relationships with my nieces and nephews. And I started having nieces and nephews way before I became a parent. So I think that was kind of the part of me that wanted to, connect with young people. And I realized as I was this morning, as I was sitting and I was thinking about my grandniece who I was teaching guitar yesterday, that I'm probably the only one of her great uncles, of which she has four, that she's got a relationship with. And it just struck me again that, oh yeah, I do this thing where I kind of love the youths in my family. So my nephew has come to some of my teachings because he's sober, and he has told me that he has given away a great many of my One Breath at a Time books. So, and we're very close. And last night we talked. We went into a long, dual rant about the world situation right now. He's very smart. He's very engaged in actually Los Angeles city politics. He works for the downtown Los Angeles. He's an executive director of what's called DTLA. Anyway, yeah, I think both of them view me in bo in, as both those, as his beloved uncle and as this person who has done some special things in the world. And that particularly with Nick, that he values that I have had a personal impact on his own spiritual life. Yeah. Well, that's a
Very cool.
sweet question.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the questions. Yeah. Deborah, hey, how you doing?
Hi.
Are you back home yet? Are you?
I am.
Okay, good for you.
Yeah, it was a long drive.
How'd it go? Yeah, was it all right?
Yeah, bumper to
Deborah
bumper.
was on the retreat, if you're not,
Yeah.
that I was just.
Being on the truth, and thank you for talking about it, reminded me of two things. One, it was a lot like life, but intensified.
Right,
And so I
long
had
question.
to every day check in to my capacities, physically, emotionally, heart and mind, and heart mind. And then, so what could I do? What was I capable of? And then just accept it. And if I needed help, ask for it. It was there, you know? And I got it and went with it, you know? So, and if I felt others needed help, and without speaking, asked for it, I could give it. And that's a wonderful thing, too, to do that without speaking.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice. Thank you. Always nice to have you along for the ride. Abigail, hi.
Hi, good to see you.
You
Sorry I
too,
wasn't
yeah.
over. I missed the retreat so badly. Two things. One of it, you mentioned old.
Yes, old, well, what I call it, older, older. And
Older.
people always say, as you get older, and I'm like, yeah, but then there's older when you're actually, anyway, go on. Never mind.
Lucas was checking out AI, so he said,
Oh, great.
Give me a question that I can ask it. So I said, okay, how old is old? So he asked AI, how old is old? And AI said, from 60 to 70 is young old. From 70 to 80 is old. From 80 on is old. So
That's
you're not
well,
old.
no, I'm
Anyway,
just
what
old
I was,
then, yeah.
you're just old.
Yeah.
I, however, I'm old.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. My question was that with the old brain, you said that it sucks, but it's okay. But I'm not sure that's exactly what you said.
Yeah, I'm not. Don't ask me what you're asking me what I said before. Come on, you know I can't remember anything.
I know, but you say it all the time.
Somebody put it in the link. This kind of sucks, but it's okay. Is that?
That's
No.
close. Well, that's what I remembered too. But then I said, did he really say so? But yes, that's this stage of my life has been a struggle that I
Yeah.
didn't expect to have. It's a family struggle. It's not,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it's not ill health.
Right.
Those things are minor. It's not, you know, there are all kinds of things that could be that it's not.
Yeah.
But the struggle that I've had is against saying this is not how it should be. And I find myself thinking that even though, and I need the reminder that It's just how it is.
Yeah.
But I still keep feeling to myself. I have a new therapist that I'm seeing today. And of
Good.
course, I have this list of things that I want him to fix because they're not okay. I thought, wait a
Right.
minute, that's not what I want. So I was really glad for the reminder of, yeah, this sucks, but it's okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry you've had to struggle with that. I hope it's, gets
It's
better.
getting better. It's getting
Good.
better.
Good. Good to know.
Thanks. Thanks for being
Enjoy
here.
your time with your therapist. That sounds comforting. Gabrielle.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
I love this Dharma talk. You may be in a bad place, but man, it really hit home for me. I thought it was fabulous. You touched on so much that I've been thinking of lately. And after 37 years of not drinking, but occasional slips, which I've talked about before, with the evil weed, I've been struggling so much since I started joining you a year or two ago with dealing with that. And it's just like the craving comes up, but I don't see it that way. And so I went back to AA meetings, and that wasn't doing it for me, just too much God and, the AA stuff. I think One Breath at a Time is an absolute masterpiece, and it helped me just immensely, and that was great. But what really seems to have happened in hindsight is that thanks to this weekly meeting and this Sangha, I've started going to reaching out to other meetings where I can go in person to a Sangha and sit at IMCW near here in near
Oh,
Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
and where Tara used to be
Yeah,
the head
yeah.
guru, but she's not there anymore. But anyway, other people have stepped up
Yeah.
and going to retreat, going to day longs, that sort of stuff, but doing a lot of reading. And I had this almost breakdown. The craving was so strong a week or two ago. I was in tears. I was begging my husband to leave me and take his weed with him, and just so that I didn't have to be around. It was really, really hard. And all of a sudden, the precepts popped into my mind. And this thing, what will this serve? How will this help you? It's just refrain from intoxicants because they cloud the mind. And like for eons, it's just like, I want to experience reality. I want to be here. I want to be present. And just that simple thing, why do you want to cloud your mind? Who will that serve? How will that help? Where is the benefit for others? And suddenly it was like a bell, and I've like been free. I've just have felt
Wow.
free, and it's just been the most amazing thing. And so I continue to do a lot of reading, and it's the Dharma, like you say. It's the whole path, and I'm by no means a scholar at any level, but I understand the basics, and somehow they're just starting to work in me, and it's just amazing. So thank you so much. This talk was just
Yeah.
extraordinary. It just was
Well, that's
perfect.
really beautiful, Gabrielle, and I just think it speaks to something which, in the AA world, they'll kind of attribute this to God, and which I don't think that's not crazy. I understand it because I attribute it to the law of karma, the accumulation of the wholesome until there's a breaking point. And because you've stayed on the path, you were accumulating, they call merit, but I don't even really love that term, but just wholesome energy on that side that eventually it tilts, and it is quite remarkable. When it probably each of us has some kind of a story about what was the moment when it just clicked, and they'd probably all be very different. Like you never know what it is that's going to make it click. And it isn't really the thing that you thought or the thing that you read or that you heard, isn't really the thing. It was everything that came before that prepared you to hear that, because those ideas were there already, and you already knew those ideas, but your mind was not ready to take them in. So you cultivated these qualities that allowed then for that click to happen. So it's beautiful. And that's my explanation, and so, but it's really lovely to hear, and I wish you well with that. Yeah. And finally, Marina, hello. You're kind of in the shadows here,
Hi, I
with
know
this
I have the light
mysterious
on
look,
here. I have this halo on.
who is it? Who is this? Who are they?
hi, thank you for the retreat once again. I was driving Vimalasara to airport and we had no traffic. It was, I thought it's going to be either no traffic because of the holiday or that it's going to be a terror, and it was just a breeze.
That's great.
Yeah, we even managed to have
And it
lunch.
was 6 hours coming up or something horrible
Yeah,
like
it was
that.
crazy for her, but that was a bad timing, like in LA can be really be. I just wanted to say that this morning I was walking my dog and I went on to listen to a voice message that I had from a friend when my phone was off during retreat. And she's struggling with physical pain badly. She broke her elbow, and literally at this point it's been 2 years, and she's been in PT and like had already two or three surgeries and is doing a really struggling. And we spoke some of physical pain at the retreat, and I've worked with some people that had physical pain, and I can't relate to that. And it's difficult for me to, like, I usually, if I can't relate to somebody's questions or things that people want to work with, I feel uncomfortable, kind of. Then I feel like I'm giving suggestions on things that I know nothing about. She's really struggling, but the interesting sentence that she said in a message was, come on, say something wise. You always have something to say. She says, I don't think I came here to have physical experience of pain. And I did not answer to her voicemail yet, but that was the first thing that came up. I was like, oh, honey, yes, you did. But then again, like, to somebody who's suffering so badly, and I know she is, I'm certainly not going to say that, but it just made me wonder. I don't really, I haven't experienced much of, I have a lot of emotional pain and existential, drag since I can remember, but I really don't have much physical pain, and I can't, relate to that really so much. She doesn't meditate. She's not the Buddhist. She does drink and she uses Prozac and she's on weed and she does a lot of other stuff, right? And so that's not a kind of approach for me. So I just thought it was interesting to hear it after retreat, especially.
I mean, one of the things I've been particularly aware of over the last couple of days, and to, like on the last night of the retreat, I said to the Vimalasara, I've gotten to the point of it's unmanageable, like exhaustion. I forget the word I used, and because there are states of pain and other physical states like exhaustion or hunger, that make it all, really narrow our capacity to just be aware and to accept or deal with it, where we're just overwhelmed. And I suppose we could say that one of the things we cultivate as meditators is to broaden that aperture, that capacity to handle physical discomfort, to handle emotional discomfort. But one of the reasons I was talking about frailty, I think, at the beginning, I was thinking about it anyway, was noticing how easily I could get tipped off with my capacity to just be mindful and accepting and present when my body is not, it is out of whack. And so, yeah, it's especially hard if you don't have any kind of perspective on that. And yeah, if your belief is this isn't supposed to be happening, it really creates an unmanageable state. And this is, for one thing, why we have an opioid, why we had at least an opioid epidemic in this country, because people thought they weren't supposed to have pain. And someone said, yeah, you're right. You aren't supposed to have pain. I'm going to, give you something so you won't have it. And then, and thus the
Yeah.
epidemic began. Yeah. Well, thank you.
You.
Thank all of you for dropping in. Hope again, people, I hope you all feel better than I do. Let me just put it that way. I know some of you probably feel worse than I do, so I am sorry if that's the case. And I don't feel that bad. I don't want you to think I feel, I just feel like, but I'm fine. It doesn't, I'm not sure it even sucks. I'm not sure it even qualifies as it sucks, but it's okay. I will say it's definitely okay. And seeing you and talking about the Dharma and being together for this hour is so comforting for me. And you should know that this is not like, oh, I have to show up and do this thing again. It's to even it's not quite it's a joy, but it's more than that. It's a comfort to me. And this community that's been so steady with me for these years is just a great comfort to have you and see you each week. And if I'm feeling crummy, like it gives me an hour to feel good. And so thank you all. And I know you don't come here to make me feel good. If you do, you've definitely got a problem. But that's how it works, right? We come together to take care of ourselves, and then the result is
Each
that we
other.
take care of each other. So that's the kind of miracle of Sangha. So many blessings.
Thank you.
I will presumably be back here, not here, but on the Zoom here, next Tuesday. And till then, be well. Keep the Dharma in mind as much as possible, and take care of yourselves.
Drive carefully.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Michelle. Bye bye.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks, Monica. I'm going to try to get on the recordings shortly. If I'm sick, I'll have plenty of time to do it, so won't have to be playing golf.
Oh.
Yeah, take care.